around.
Good, thank you. Welcome, everyone. Particularly if you're just joined us, first time, particularly welcome. I should point out this is going to be a little bit different from our usual Bible study thing. So if you think, well, that's a bit weird what I've come into, don't panic. It's not what we do all the time. We're going to keep Jackie waiting just a little bit longer to reveal what the mystery item is for today, because we've been looking at Acts recently and we've sort of gone through it as much as I particularly wanted to and so on. But this doesn't mean that we've necessarily finished with it. If people have got contributions to make, little snippets here and there, extra thoughts from having read through the book. So I'm going to pause to start with to see if you want to comment on anything still from your reading the book of Acts, because I know we've got one contribution. So we're going to start with Kit, who I hope is here somewhere. Oh, I see it. Yes, Kit. Can you,
unmute myself? Yes. I mean, first of all, I really enjoyed doing Acts with a specific kind of question in mind. I don't think I've ever done it before in Acts specifically. But anyway, what I noticed, which raised a question for myself, because I noticed that several times in Acts, it mentions clearly that Paul knelt down to pray. Obviously, it was his custom in certain circumstances as a group to kneel down to pray. So my question to myself was, whatever happened to kneeling to pray? When I first became a believer, I was in an Anglican situation, and that was very common then to kneel during sort of collective prayer time. And I'm just asking myself, really, you know, what happened, and what is the specific kind of relevance to kneeling to pray, and have we kind of lost it as evangelicals?
So any comments on that? Do people still kneel to pray either in their services or at home, and do they feel that it's a useful thing to do as part of your prayer attitude? Hands have gone up. I hope I don't know if it's to do with this question or something else, but no, I think it's Malcolm that needs to come in next.
Yeah, well, what I was going to say was the Jews always used to kneel to pray, I gather, and then they found the Christians were doing it and said, "Oh, well, we're not kneeling anymore."
Right. The examples in Acts that I know of is when Paul is saying farewell to the Ephesian elders, and they all kneel to pray. And there's another occasion where, again, it's in a group. It's we knelt to pray, and he's on a beach, part of his journeying around. But the other one I remember is that Jesus, didn't he kneel in Gethsemane?
Yeah, in Luke 22.
Yeah, particularly. And Paul writes to the Ephesians saying, "I kneel before God, the Father in heaven, when I think of you all," whether that is literally doing it or whether he's using it as an expression. But I guess it's to do with the whole idea of submitting yourself, perhaps even doing something different and unusual so that you focus a bit better. That's the whole point of prayer anyway. I mean, personally, I find it a little tricky these days to get down and then up again. But obviously, if you're doing it in church, you might have a kneeling mat or some other means of help and so on. Is this a comment on that, Mike? Do you want to say something about this?
Yeah. Am I right in thinking that the Hebrew word for kneel implies bowing down, you know, lowering yourself in some way, because it's a kind of mark of humbling yourself before the Lord?
And indeed, the whole idea of worship is to bow down. I think that's linked in with it as well. I also think it links in with the word to bless. There is a root word for kneeling which links in with barak, meaning to bless, or baruch. Okay. So like a lot of Hebrew words, it has lots of meaning. So it isn't just the physical thing, it's to do with the whole attitude, I think, behind it. Yeah. So, John, do you want to come in now?
Yeah, no, this is about the kneeling. Yeah. We also see in several instances, I think, in the Older Testament, of people prostrating themselves before the Lord.
Yeah.
And certainly in some cultures, prostration is part and parcel of that, obeisance to whoever it is that's the higher authority.
Mm. Yeah. So I suppose if it helps the praying, then fine. Otherwise, it's just a gesture which doesn't make any real difference. But maybe it's something that we have lost, given that we should do that. The point is that, as I said, going through the book of Acts, ask yourself, what can I learn about? And you can put at the end of that all sorts of different things, like what do I learn about witness and evangelism and teaching and praying and so on. So that's maybe an answer to one of those questions, or keeping your eye open for that sort of thing. Now, John, did you want to add something else then? Did you have your hand up for an earlier reason?
Yes, if we're moving on.
Yeah.
I noticed as part of what I was looking through, I was looking through David Pawson's big book on, and that included Acts, and I got to the point, he says in, and if we look at chapter 6, verse 1 in Acts, now in those days, I'm using the New King James, now in those days when the number of the disciples were multiplying, there arose a complaint against the Hebrew by the Hellenists.
Yeah.
I have a note in my Bible that is Greek-speaking Jews. Now, in the note that David Pawson has, well, don't give him a hard time, poor guy, but anyway, because he's got lots of good stuff, he says that the beginning of chapter 6, this describes how the Gentile widows' complaints. Now, one, I think there would have been a lot more surprise a lot earlier on if they had really all been Gentiles. And because when Peter, you know, we've talked about Peter and Cornelius and so on, and the surprise and astonishment and so on that the Gentiles are now coming in. But interestingly, when you see the list of those who are set to serve as leaders, the last one there, Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch, and therefore a Gentile. But at this point, there's nothing nothing that I could see anyway that raises any concern. Oh, how did the Gentiles get in? Of course, if they were a long-term true proselyte, I guess that means that they were effectively, as God says in, and the stranger amongst you needs to be undertaking in the same way that the Jewish people do in relation to God and so on.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting one that it's a shame that David's got the Gentile widows, but because of that proselyte name, it raises some interesting questions also, because Hellenists were usually those guys who were against the Maccabees. That's why the Maccabees rose up, because of the Hellenists. But presumably, if they were not fully blown into Hellenism, they were actually going to God's house and celebrating the appointed times and all the rest of it, and therefore they were seen to be, in fact, true Jewish people who were acceptable from, I don't know, doctrinal point of view? I don't know.
Well, yeah, thank you. That is very interesting. And I had picked up the fact that Nicholas from Antioch was a convert or proselyte. You could, of course, convert in more than one way. So you had the God-fearers and you had the true proselytes. Some of them, if you like, joined in completely, and that would include circumcision, whereas I think a God-fearer didn't. So you could be attached to Judaism without coming fully into the whole bag of tricks, if you like, the whole setup. But I suppose what made a difference when it came to Cornelius and so on was that this was clearly God endorsing a mission now to the Gentiles generally, that they were going to come in not just in ones and twos and not just in sort of proselyte form, but in a totally different way. So it would still be quite a surprise, because then the question was going to be, well, how much should these new Gentile converts become part of the church as they had it then. The difference between the Hebraic Jews, and was the Hebrew-speaking Jews that were already in Jerusalem, and sometimes the Grecian or the Hellenist or the, not really Gentiles, but they're still Jews, but the Jews of the diaspora is what I'm trying to say, seemed to cause a bit of there was a sort of division between them in some ways, and that's why there was this complaint and how they had to sort it out, as though there was some kind of favouritism still between one kind of Jew and another kind of Jew, even though they're both converted into the new new form with Jesus. So, thank you. All right. Anybody else got any snippets on Acts? And if not, keep reading and bring something in the next few weeks that interests you. We will be starting a new book of the Bible next time. And I'm going to keep that under my hat as well for a while. And maybe in whatever time it takes, when we get towards the end, I've got one or two other questions to throw out for a bit of general consideration. But the mystery topic, if you like, for today is reality. I'm going to talk about reality, and I'm going to talk about it in one particular context, which you'll understand in a moment or two. But I want to start off with sort of how we experience things. What is real for us? And is that actually the complete reality of things? Let me start with this. How do you think your eyesight is? I don't mean are you wearing glasses, contact lenses, whether you've been to the opticians recently, whether you've got cataracts, anything like that. But in terms of your eyesight, you actually have a very limited range of sight. Think about it. There's a lot more things out there that you cannot see because you're not physically able to see outside of a certain range of frequencies. And yet you know that there's ultraviolet and infrared, and you know there's things called x-rays, but of course you don't have x-ray vision and you don't normally see outside of your normal range. You don't have x-ray vision, you don't see the things that you can when you do all that sort of thing. So there's something here that's interesting. You have sight, but it is limited. It is designed to be limited. It's designed to function in a way that helps you in your life, but there is a greater reality on the outside of it. What about sound, as in hearing? Again, we have a form of ability to pick things up according to certain wavelengths, but we also know that there's frequencies higher and lower than what we can normally experience, and other animals do experience them, dogs, bats, whales, dolphins, that sort of thing. So again, we are living within a shorter span than the whole range of things. We know this more outside of there, but we live within our own particular reality. And I'm going to come to another one in a minute, but I just want to play with this idea for a little bit longer. Do you think the earth is flat or not? Own up. Anyone here believe the earth is flat? The question though is why not? Tell me why you don't believe it's flat.
Well, because from space you can see the curvature.
Right. So okay, but have you ever been into space? I mean,
no, I've been on Concorde. You can actually see the curvature of the earth with that.
In other words, yeah, in the past, if people thought the Earth was flat, it was for a very good reason, because it looked flat. And until you start to travel to huge distances or indeed leave the surface, there's no problem. Your level of reality is that the Earth is flat. And for most of your daily living, for all intents and purposes, the Earth is flat. And I don't mean there aren't valleys and hills and that sort of thing, but it doesn't make the slightest bit of difference to your daily life, the fact that you're on a massive sphere. And yet somehow you know that that isn't the full reality. But there is a limited reality that you're quite happy with. I saw a hand go up. I'm very happy to stop and take questions and comments at any time on this, because it slows me down from everything else. Mike, do you want to say something?
Yeah, the only thing I was thinking of is, I can't remember where the scripture is. I think it's in Isaiah or in Job, where the Lord says that the earth hangs on nothing.
Yeah.
you know, that it's...
Yeah, there are hints in Scripture, and that's, we need to keep coming back to Scripture. It's interesting, because sometimes the Scriptures are trying to describe the earth in a way that we can understand and experience, and at other times it sort of goes, oh, how does that work? Other times it's sort of, it's fixed on the pillars or something, you know, it's sort of built on certain pillars. So is the earth flat? Well, yes, but no. In reality, it isn't, but in our reality, it sort of is. That's what I'm heading in on this. Is the earth actually fixed then in space? They don't believe it's actually fixed. No, not anymore. But in the ancient world, if you believe the earth was fixed, that was perfectly reasonable, because you got no extra information to tell you that actually you were spinning at a huge rate, and therefore why aren't you falling off? And you're whizzing around in a huge elliptical orbit as well. Again, how on earth are we managing to cope with that? Because you don't feel it, you don't experience it. Again, you sitting there, to all intents and purposes, reality for you is that the earth is absolutely fixed. And now you know differently because of other information, the way things have developed, and you've seen pictures and you understand what other people are saying on this, and yet it doesn't bother you in your daily life. You still operate as though it's back to just being fixed and flat and all the rest of it. So even if, go on then, John.
Yeah, but it is kind of solid, and, you know, it's not fickle in that every day is completely different.
Yeah, okay, there's a routine, there's a regularity.
There's a solidity to it.
Yeah.
That then made people to say it's fixed, I would have thought.
Well, by fixed, I mean everything else rotates around this. You know, the earth is the centre of all things and everything else moves, which, of course, is the great Galileo-Copernicus argument from the past. And even Calvin believed in a fixed earth. Even as late as Calvin, he believed in a fixed earth. And if the Bible seems to describe it like that, well, fair enough, because it's using the sort of language that we all use, which is the language of appearances. It's called phenomenal language, in other words, the phenomena is what we use to describe it, or it's poetic, if you like. And even if you're a diehard scientist and you fully understand all the physics and the equations to do with it all, you're still quite happy to talk about a sunrise and a sunset, knowing full well that that never happens. Okay, the sun itself is moving as well, in an extraordinary sort of way, but to all intents and purposes, the reality for us is that, yeah, the sun gets up in the morning, does a journey across the sky, and goes to bed at night. And that defines the way we think about a day, for instance. Now, all that, I suppose, is sort of okay. We've got sort of used to that sort of thing. But there's another form of reality which is not as straightforward as we think, and that's the nature of time. So I'm actually going to bamboozle you a little bit, really, perhaps, with the whole idea of the weirdness, the mystery, that time is far more than we actually normally experience. We live, like we do with these other things, within a limited range of experience, and yet outside of that, there is a mystery, there's another reality which is far greater. And if anything, it should point us towards God. It should give us not complete understanding, but some kind of glimpse as to, oh, wow, God did that. And that's what it might be like eventually when God recreates and so on. So we're going to look at the idea of time and think what it's like when we go outside of our normal experience or reality of it. And just like science has progressed in other ways, of course, science is no longer as it was 200 or 300 years ago, when time was actually a key factor of all the equations and all the physics and so on. And since then, we've understood, at least some people have understood, what relativity is about, the very large, and what the quantum ideas are like, the very, very small. And again, that's going outside of our range of experiences in normal life. So it's out there in a different sort of way, and it's different from our normal assumptions. So what do we assume about time normally? We assume that it's sort of flows, it runs uniformly. There's a sort of linear aspect to it, and that time is the same for every single one of us. And somehow, just out there, there's this big sort of clock going tick, 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 and that measures the whole of time, and we sort of join in on that. Time is universal, it's obvious, and yet actually it doesn't work in that way at all throughout the whole universe. Okay, I'm going to come back to the point that our internal understanding of time is very different from the whole external universal thing of time. When God created time, he didn't make it just as we experience it. He made it much more, much bigger, much more mysterious and extraordinary. And then we just experience it in a certain way. Okay, I'm going to make some specific points in a moment, but does anyone want to comment now before I go off into anything too complicated? Yeah, John?
Time. Seriously important when you're measuring things.
Right.
And so, for example, they continue to develop atomic clocks. And my brother was involved in one of these attempts or efforts or things, because without time and navigation, and other folk will know this, Malcolm will know this probably, without time your navigational processes are impossible, effectively.
Yes.
So, and with satellites and with GPS and all these things, actually, the finer, the smaller parts of time are even more important than seconds, if you like.
Now, what do you think is the smallest unit of time that we as human beings, so not having devised other mechanical means like atomic clocks, can actually experience and grasp and effectively react to? Is it 1 second? Is it less than a second?
I would have thought a second, but...
Blink.
Taking another example, a colleague of mine was working in the forest with a horse, and as an apprentice, if you like, and one of the chains snapped, and it was then like a bullet. There's the rest of this chain coming straight for him because the horse was pulling a big log. So, and he described later that it was like a slow motion video. He didn't have time to move. He couldn't move. There wasn't sufficient, the time hadn't changed so that his brain could then make him move, if you like. But nonetheless, his perception of time was completely different. Multi-million parts of seconds at that point, I guess.
So under certain extreme circumstances, our normal internal clock functions differently. We all know in general terms sometimes, oh, time flies, we're really enjoying it. And other times, boy, that's dragged a lot, isn't it? Which you're probably thinking already is the case with this evening. But hopefully time will become... But the answer to my own question there is, under normal circumstances, anything under a tenth of a second is beyond our ability to deal with it.
Absolutely.
And I think of, you know, people in sport and so on, batsmen have to react to fast bowling within about 0.4 of a second, and somehow they manage to do it. They can train their reactions. But anything less than a tenth of a second, we cannot pick up. Okay, I'll come back to that again in a minute. Alison, do you want to say something now?
Yeah, I agree with you about the tenth of a second. I think it's about 0.15 for touch.
Okay.
Audio is 0.17. But the other thing that's kind of... in my mind is about the time that we have in our human calculations for our calendars and everything.
Right.
In the Bible, the Jewish year is 5783, I think, that from the point of man's creation. And then you've got all this stuff about carbon dating, and then there's all the arguments about young Earth and so on.
Okay, I'm not going into that at the moment.
No.
I'm happy to mention it, but don't expect us to go into that at the moment, okay?
I'm not where I'm going with it. It's whether God gave us, as you're saying, our perception of time is one thing, and whether God gave us that perception of time at the point of creating man. Yeah. That it was all part and parcel of it. So
that's what I am getting to, that when he created us,
the ripple and picking up the ripple from outer space and where that, how many light years away it is and all that, that's not actually kind of relevant to our perception of the time that man has been on the universe, on the earth.
Okay, I'm not picking up those ideas at the moment, otherwise I'm going to get very distracted on that. I just want to say that when God created time and then he created us so that we could, if you like, pick up time in a certain way. How we've then chosen to measure it and so on is a separate story. I might mention something of that. And the whole idea of atomic clocks becoming more important is relevant in a minute as well. But I also want to go to the other extreme and say, because we cannot experience time at a very, very small amount, anything less than a tenth of a second is effectively meaningless, even though we can devise clocks to deal with it and so on. Equally, anything at a much larger scale is also impossible for us to comprehend. So, for instance, if I said to you, how do you understand a year? You're fine, because you experience life in years. And you can probably go to 10 years and even further to, say, 100 years, because that's roughly a lifespan. And you might be able to extrapolate that further. But if I said you just stop and imagine a million years, you would find that very difficult, because the only way you can do it is to sit and imagine a clock going tick-tock, tick-tock for a million years. And it's way beyond anything that we can really comprehend. In fact, as we'll see later, that might not even be meaningful and so on. And I know mathematically, a million years is a million times longer than 1 year. But in terms of our reality, it goes beyond our reality and therefore becomes pretty meaningless. Okay, I'll keep taking other comments, but I do want to keep moving on because we do have a limited time on this. Carolyn.
Yes, I wanted to ask whether this is to do with in Ephesians 3, verse 18. But he talks about the love of God, because they talk about the four dimensions there, don't they? And one of them time.
I don't know. I don't know the verse you're talking to. If you're going to have a verse, can you quote it?
Yes. Well, from 17. So Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth.
Oh, okay.
And the love of Christ.
So all right. I take that as just a poetic symbol of meaning everything. Okay.
Do you? Okay.
Well, I don't see any need to try and analyse those as four different things, because
I think if time is one of them, and it's like another dimension that we.
Well, yeah. Okay. Fair enough. And then there's more after that. But I'm not sure that that's relevant to that verse. Can I move on, please? Sorry, yes. I don't get to. John, is it relevant to what we're talking about?
You kind of mentioned perception of time, and. I had another situation where time seemed man's time, as you mentioned, was 70 years or 60. Well, our perceptive professional time when we're observing things is probably about 40, 50 years, perhaps. And in relation to a life cycle of a forest and a tree,
mm-hmm.
that was involved in, it could be a lot larger. And so. Within, say the life cycle of a forest is 150 years, then one individual, it's impossible for them to see effectively minor changes in that forest from an ecological point of view, because they don't live long enough. They can't
exactly
see. So it's very difficult to see those longer term, not even very long term, changes without having, well, a written history or at least some other evidence of that.
And yet sometimes we're asked to do that, and it makes me wonder just how much I'm meant to accept all that. Now, what I'm going to say next, I assure you, is not science fiction. It is science fact. It is very mathematical. And bear in mind all the time that I'm talking about things which are real, but they're not real to our known experience of things. So firstly, time passes faster the higher up you are. Time does not go at the same rate on a mountaintop as it does at sea level. So the higher up you are, the faster time goes. So if you've got two people, one living on the mountains and one on the plain at sea level, the one on the plain actually ages less. There's less time lower down. Now, it is a minuscule difference that you and I will never notice, so we didn't panic about that. But actually, time flows at a different rate between your head and your feet. But that's over such a small distance of time that we're dealing with billionths and billionths of a second, so we don't actually notice it. And yet it is a fact that time, not only does it flow at different rates in different parts of the universe, even within the scope of our planet, if you like, it travels at it passes at different speeds according to how far away we are from the center of the Earth. And there's a reason for that, which I won't go into at the moment. The other thing that affects the flow of time is mass and speed. Time is slowed down by speed and by mass. Now, nobody would have thought of that. Intuitively, it doesn't make sense, but it is actually true. And this is where, if you want to go back to the idea of space and time being four dimensions and joined together as a single entity, a continuum, as they call it, that's where it starts to make sense. But everything that's got mass affects the flow of time. So a mass like the Earth slows time down around itself to some extent, but you get a bigger body out there, a bigger planet, star, and so on, it will slow time down even more. So time passes at different rates according to the size of the object. It also goes at different rates according to how fast you are traveling. So if two people, one standing still and walking, and one is walking around, time passes more slowly for the one who is moving. So if you want to age less, then you have to move around more. And all this is verifiable because we've got atomic clocks that measure things to these billionths of a second and so on. The faster you go, and they put clocks on planes and sent them zipping around the Earth and kept another clock on the Earth, and when eventually the plane landed and they compared the two clocks, they could understand that the one that had moved had experienced a different time, a slower time. Time has contracted for it. So time slows down in the universe according to the mass that's there and also the speed at which you're going. And the whole thing, space and time, is distorted by these two features, like a big sort of elastic sheet, where gravity is busy sort of pulling it in all sorts of directions. But time is distorted as well. Have you heard of black holes? Mm-hmm. Okay, who can define a black hole? Who actually knows what we're talking about here?
Place where things disappear.
Yeah, do you know why they disappear?
Good question.
Anyone know actually what a definition of a black hole is?
Very dense.
That it's black and it's a hole.
No. Very, very dense. Everything falls into it and you can't, and light cannot even escape out of it.
And they're formed usually by a star collapsing. So you get a massive object like a star. It eventually burns itself out and dies, and it can go in different ways, but it can collapse to the size of perhaps just my fist, tennis ball or something. All its mass is concentrated at a phenomenal way into a small volume, and because it's so dense and so on, it not only affects gravity, but it slows time down, and on the border of it, time stands still. So, and also because the gravitational field is so strong, anything that goes in there can never get out again. Not even light can escape it. Nothing can escape it because its gravitational field has got so intense. But that's an extreme example of how around black holes in space, everything is so distorted and curved that time itself runs very different rate. And if you were to go at the speed of light, for instance, you would also start to slow down. But of course, you can't travel that fast. Now, this is not too unusual in the sense that if you think about a river doesn't flow uniformly necessarily, does it? Have you ever noticed that? What the thing I'm talking about here, about the flow of a river? Not every bit of water flows at the same rate. Because if it's on the edge, it's probably got some drag from the bank. okay? And the middle of a river can actually flow more quickly. And of course, there might be other things disturbing it, okay? So I'm just going to give that as a bit of, a, of an example and so on. So the first point here is that there is no such thing as universal time, one sort of clock ticking away. It was never created to be like that. It appears like that to us because we operate within very short, limited ways. In other words, we don't go zooming around at high speed and we don't travel through all of space and so on. Within the confines of our life on this planet and so on, then just like we don't notice that it's curved and we don't notice that it's moving very, very quickly, for all intents and purposes, for us, time is actually going at the same rate. And yet, for reasons I've explained, there is no actual single time. Okay? I'll come back to that a little bit in a minute. So if you ask the question, then what is happening now, that again becomes a rather meaningless sort of question. Anyone know how long it takes for light to reach us from the sun? Anyone heard that fact? You know, when you see the sunlight.
5 seconds?
No, it's not seconds, it's more.
Minutes then?
Yeah, it's 8 minutes, about 8 minutes. So if you're saying nine, that's about okay then, yeah. So actually, if you think about it, you never see the sun as it is now. I know you shouldn't look at the sun anyway, but I'm just trying to use an illustration. There is no now that's common to you and to something at that distance away. Everything has its own now, its own present. What is present to us is not necessarily present to someone elsewhere. But for all intents and purposes, on our planet, in our short range of distances and so on, it isn't going to make the slightest bit of difference. But just like time is personal to each one of us, the present is also individual to each one of us. And it's actually different from somebody else in the same room. We don't technically share the same now or present. But if we're only a few meters apart, then it's nanoseconds, and therefore we don't notice it. If you go thousands of meters apart, then your two nows are milliseconds apart, and again, beyond our experience and so on. The only time we get any indication of that is if you send someone to the moon and you know there's a bit of a delay in hearing them, okay? There's a time lag, isn't there, as things get sent throughout space and so on. Malcolm?
If you watch TV news, for instance, you'd have a reporter who is some way away from the studio, and the presenter asks the question, there is always a delay before the reporter out starts his reply, because you've got the time up to the satellite and
exactly. Then that's what makes the real difference. Just in case you're ever watching football on television, you are never seeing it live. It's always a little bit, a couple of seconds behind because of the way the signal is being sent and so on. Now, that's an extreme case, but it makes it understandable to us because we can sort of get that bit of it. If someone, though, is just the other side of the field and you're trying to communicate, there is a slight delay, but it's just not noticeable because it's well below our threshold of noticing differences in it and so on. So another way of putting this is that although we think of time as a nice line with a past, a present and a future, and it sort of flows from one to the other and there's an actual present in the middle of it like a dot, yes, that's true for each one of us, but we all have our own individual timeline where our present can be slightly off from someone else's. Again, there is no universal now. There is no universal present. There's something else to say on that later, which is even more sort of ridiculous. But basically, time, we think of time now as the way we've measured it in clocks. And we've therefore tried to regulate it, when in fact it's quite elastic in our experience. Apparently the word time actually comes from a word that just means divide. So it's a way of saying that we've divided what is the natural periods of time, like the day, into smaller divisions, like hours and so on. And even before we got clocks, they had sundials, hourglasses, water clocks, and so on. They just weren't quite as precise as we started to get later on. Mechanical clocks came in around about the 14th century. And apparently the whole point of a clock was that they would all at least tell the same time if they were set appropriately. But actually that's not technically true. And I won't go into all the details of this, but as you know, midday is different in different parts of the world. So they had to fix a meridian, the Greenwich Mean Time. As it turned out, it was in the middle of London. And even within a short distance within the country, midday would have been different from the one in London. It might be 2 or 3 minutes difference. Now, you can't go there. You can't live like that. So they had to regulate it. And in particular, this happened once the trains came in and they had to try and put a timetable together and make trains run on time. So in the 19th century, instead of each train having, each station having its own clock, which could be a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes different from where it started, you had to create time zones and have everybody within the time zone following the same clock. But before all that, the only way you had of measuring time, you won't be surprised to know, was the alternation of day and night. The sun, moon and stars marking off the seasons and the days and so on. Time has become more regulated by us, whether it's in a good way or not a good way. That depends what we're trying to do. But it enables, obviously, to try and synchronize certain things. We're trying to sort of make time fit our lifestyle and our ways of doing things, which is fair enough. But the greater reality of it is that there is no absolute time that flows uniformly by itself, and we're sort of tapping into that. Okay. Now, all the original science from Newton onwards was based upon a universal flow, regular flow of time. And that's fine because it works at that level. So it enabled you to do all the sort of things that you needed to do at that point. It's only when you go into the much bigger and the much smaller that all that breaks down, as Einstein began to understand in all this, and eventually in quantum mechanics and so on, the time just didn't fit the way we thought that it did. Not something to worry about because we don't live at those other levels, but time actually has almost a life of its own. And there's a whole myriad of different times. It's like a web of time out there, of which our experience of it is just one form of it. I'm going to tell you something even more extraordinary in a minute, but in order to comment so far, you're just getting the main idea, which is basically all I want to really get across, that time is a remarkable thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's part of God's creation, and we only understand it in part, like we do a lot of things that God has done and made.
I think we're hanging on by our fingernails.
Okay, are you ready to disappear completely here? If you go small enough, time ceases to exist. You might think, well, I just keep dividing it and you go to a millionth of a second, a billionth of a second, and so on. There comes a point in which time no longer features in the physics and the way the universe actually works. Now, you needn't worry about it. It's something like 10 to the power minus 44 of a second. And even I'm lost here with how many millions of trillions it is. But the point is, you can't go on subdividing time indefinitely. It eventually disappears. Time does not exist. Extraordinary. And it's as though, how can I put it? It sort of comes into existence in order to enable us to live in a certain way, because we can't live without time at some level. I don't know how much more to go into that. Perhaps I won't go into that too much. But now they do physics, they do mathematics at that level without having any reference to time, because they don't need it. In the old mechanics and the old physics doing things, everything was done with respect to time. And now it's realized that there is not a single universal time. and therefore that doesn't work in certain levels. It's almost as though that time sort of emerges within our existence in order to suit the way that we operate. But basically, of course, that is God that's created in that sort of way. Just like, as I tried to say earlier, in a way it's more understandable, just like we see certain things, but we don't see other things, we are created to see what we need to see. And we're created to hear what we need to hear and to be able to operate in the way that we do. So time has been designed in a strange sort of way in all sorts of different aspects of it, but it's also designed so that we can have it as part of our existence, which is something that God wants us to have. Okay, but there is a difference between our internal perception and consciousness of time and the actual universal idea of time generally, and so on. Even Augustine got that sort of ideas right. He says, the passing of time is internal to each one of us. Your clock is actually different from mine, but to such a minute difference that we just never notice. We never notice. So we can still relate, we can still operate together, we can still turn up at the same time, roughly, by relating to external devices and so on. But actually we operate, and our time understanding operates differently according, as I've said, to where we are, how fast we're going, but none of that makes any real difference in the framework in which we live. But also, and perhaps I better not go into this too much, but there comes in certain circumstances, there comes a point where the present isn't just a particular moment, it becomes an interval of time. It expands. It all depends upon where you are and what's happening in the universe and all the events around you. In other words, the idea of the present can expand and sort of push the present and the past and the future apart a little bit in order to create a different length and interval, a duration of present. How does that work? Who knows? But it's all there in the maths of it all, the physics of it all. I've probably nearly finished what I want to do on this. I am going on to something else in a minute, which relates to this. It's known that actually for most things, you can reverse time and it won't make the slightest bit of difference. Okay, Pat, you want to say something or are you just...
I'm just curious, how does that... Because you have like an internal body clock.
We have several, apparently. We have neural ones and chemical ones and hormonal ones, all regulating systems within us so that things happen at a good rate, I suppose it is. And therefore, that's why we tend to want to live within the days and the weeks and so on that we actually have. In other words, we don't hibernate because different creatures have them at different ways. But that's not the same as, mine might be slightly different to yours, but that's not quite the same as saying that we might have different ways of operating within time, but that's not the same as saying that for us time goes at different rates, which is for different reasons. I don't know any more about that. I don't know anyone else knows more about our internal clocks and how our body functions with these different things. Okay, so I suppose what I was just about to say there is that actually, if you want, in most mathematical equations and concepts and things, you can actually reverse time and it makes no difference. Extraordinarily, the only thing that stops time from going backwards or reversing on itself or doing something really weird like that is actually heat. The one law that actually regulates the universe in this is a law of thermodynamics, which you know of because it's the fact that hot things get colder and cold things can't get hotter, at least not by themselves. You have to burn things and create energy to do that. So actually, the thing that dictates the direction of flow of time is that something that's hot, if it gets colder, then that's gone from the past to the future. That tells you which direction time is going on. Without that happening, okay, if things didn't work that way, then you could actually reverse the whole of time and not notice. It's rather extraordinary. But it's a bit like a pendulum going backwards and forwards. Now, if you were to film it and reverse the film of it, you would see exactly the same thing, because it appears to be just doing the same thing whichever way you go on it. But of course, our life isn't like that because of this other property, which actually says basically everything's slowing down, everything's getting cooler, energy levels are changing from one kind to another and so on. Again, I don't understand all the implications of this. But there is something in the nature of the time that God has created that says there is a beginning and an end, and you are moving in a certain direction. Otherwise, you could sort of play around with it and end up wondering whether you could go back in time and so on. Well, you can't, not because time doesn't operate like that, but because of other factors as well. Okay. I want to move on to another related, but probably slightly easier thing to look at. But all I'm trying to do is open up for you the fact that time is weird. There's a greater reality out there. So when people ask things like, what's it going to be like when we leave this world? What is time going to be like afterwards? The question is, who knows, in one sense, because it's in that other reality that we don't have any experience of yet, and yet it seems to somehow be there already. God has somehow enabled the whole thing to work in a certain way, and it's only because we are within a certain limited framework that we only experience it in part at the moment. Okay, Pat?
I'm just interested because, you know, we're talking about climate change and the heating up of the Earth.
Yeah.
How is that going to affect us then with regarding time?
It won't, as far as I can, I don't quite get the difference between it. For start, I don't understand all the climate change arguments anyway, but that's us doing something. That's an artificial thing. That's us making differences.
Okay, it's just that you were talking about thermodynamics that changes.
The law of thermodynamics says that if you make a cup of tea and leave it, it will get cooler, not hotter. Okay, things naturally will tend to go from a higher level of heat to a lower level. And it's called thermal time, how something changes over time. And in fact, the change of temperature of something, when left to itself, is a way of showing that time is moving and it's going from the past to the future, because things don't reverse. If something's got cooler and something's got hotter, we'd have a real problem with time because it seems to be flowing in two directions at the same time, whatever that means. Okay, but the fact that we heat things up or artificially change things, that's not the same thing at all. Okay, just like obviously we make the cup of tea hot in the first place by burning something and creating electricity and so on. So, what I'm going to do now, and
can I ask a question, please?
Yeah, go on. Not sure I'll answer it, but go on.
Yeah, the difference between circular time and linear time. Because the way that we think of is linear time, and yet the Hebrews and the Oriental way of thinking is circular time.
As in history repeats itself and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, everything goes round in a circle. So the seasons go round each year, and the clock's round, and electrons go round protons, and the Earth goes round the sun.
Exactly. That again is the language of appearance, isn't it? That because things go round in cycles, they assumed therefore that the whole of history, for want of a better way of putting it, was also therefore circular, which therefore made some sense from that point of view. It's almost as though the Hebrews had an extra understanding, revelation, if you like, that actually, no, it wasn't like that, because they believed in the beginning something happened, and they believed that there was purpose and progress because God was in charge, and that therefore there would be an end. So, yes, that's a perception on how history, if you like, was going to be worked out. But again, to all intents and purposes, and if you read the book of Ecclesiastes, he does a very good job of, I think, parodying this whole philosophical point of view, that in the end, everything just goes round in a circle, ends up where it started off, and you got nowhere. Life is meaningless and so on, from a philosophical point of view. So, yeah, it was a very common view on that. Mike?
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by you know, like in studying, you know, in the New Testament, especially Revelation, the two words for time, because you've got Kairos,
yeah,
and Chronos,
yeah,
and it's really, really important, you know, when people, when you are studying, to realize, you know, what that particular thing means.
You'd like to explain the difference for us?
Not really. I mean, all I've seen is that there are definitely passages where Jesus is definitely talking about linear time of things happening. It's like with the seals and the judgments and things like that. You know, there is a sequence, in other words, to it.
Yes. Okay. So chronos is related to our idea of chronology, chronological chronometers, and so on. It almost means clock time. It means the regular movement of time that we are familiar with. Okay. Kairos time is almost like the moment where, for instance, you suddenly feel time has stopped still, or, you know, you're not sort of following the normal regular pattern of time. And it can be a long period of time or a short period of time. It's best to say, you know, I was in the moment when this happened. And it's more an experience of things almost outside of the normal regularity of time passing. And therefore, it's to give a sense that things have still happened in time, but without it being measured in a particular way. Which is a very good link to looking at a little bit of Genesis and chapter 1. And all that I've been saying and I'm about to say has been stimulated by reading a very interesting little book by a guy called John Lennox. You may have come across him. He's a scientist who's also a very good Bible scholar. And in this very interesting little book, which is very easy and short to read, he talks about 7 days that divide the world, by which he means that the opening of Genesis is a controversial passage which has divided opinion on what it's all about. And because he understands the nature of time and the science and all this sort of thing, and yet believes the Bible, he's able to come to some very interesting comments, I think, which I'm going to share with you for discussion, which may be helpful in us getting into the text a little bit more. So I'm going to be focusing on the opening chapter or two of Genesis in these comments, but without doing a full study on it, because there's obviously some relation here to the idea of time. And yet the question is it actually just using phenomenal language, or is it actually talking chronologically, if you like? And as I said before, because our experience is limited, the real danger is that we use our limited experiences and then try and interpret things that are outside of that in our own terms. And that's why I'm quite bothered, really, when someone starts talking to me about things being hundreds of millions of years or billions of years. I can't compute that, so I'm not even too sure what people are trying to get at, other than, well, it's a long time, okay, but how do we know how long that time was? Because it's quite possible, from everything that I've said, that, shall we say, a million years is not a million times longer than 1 year. It all depends what else has been happening. Time does not flow in that sort of way. It only means what we would normally think of a million years if you are sitting still in the same place on the same planet all the time and watching a clock go tick-tock. And if you want to do that for a million years, well, to get an understanding of it, well, good luck. So when we talk about these huge amounts of time, and we talk about it as though it relates to our own perception of time, I begin to think, I wonder if that's sensible. But that's the next little bit here. But what we do learn is that in the beginning, God set everything going. We don't know when the beginning was, and so on. But the Bible does use human-based language in order to tell us certain things. Now, so when you've got, for instance, in Genesis 1, the first point, and these are points that he makes, which I think is quite interesting, is that, first of all, the first two verses are detached from the way it starts in verse 3. In other words, the first two verses don't relate to the days that are following. So whatever you're going to make of the days, the first day, second day, and so on, verses 1 and 2 are not part of those days. They're not part of day 1, for instance. It's as though the story begins and then it sort of begins again. So how you link together the first two verses, there's a narrative structure about it which makes this clear, apparently, that we should be very careful about, should we say, deducing something from verses 1 and 2 and fitting it into verse 3. It's almost like you've got an introduction and then you begin the narrative that's done in days. In the first 5 days, it is different from day 6 and 7. Now, it may not come across in the translation. If you look at verse 5, chapter 1, Genesis 1, 5, there was evening and there was morning. And I wonder what you've got in your translation. What does it say about that? There was evening, there was morning. And then what does it say?
Day 1.
Day 1. Okay, that's good. What else has someone got?
Were the first day.
The first day. You've got the word the.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, that's not in the original text.
It doesn't have it in italics here, and they normally would.
Well, okay, but there is no definite article in that day. So day 1 is a slightly better way of putting it. When you get to...
It's got... And there was evening and there was morning, one day.
One day, yeah. Yeah. But not the first. It's one day or day one. You can choose however you want to express it. Now, what do you get when you get to day 6? Where's day 6 come in? That's verse 31, right at the end.
The sixth day.
Well, okay. Anyone still got day 6, for instance, or? Because actually now there is a definite article in the text. So now you can say the sixth day, and you can actually say the seventh day. God blessed the seventh day. Now, what you make of that, it's up to you really, but it's very unusual grammatically that the first 5 days have no definite article. There's no the there. It's just day 1, day 2, or 1 day, 2 day, whatever. And then it becomes the sixth day and the seventh day. Quite what the writer's trying to intend through that, obviously leaves people to try and work that out, but it's a very unusual way of describing it, that it doesn't seem to be done the same way all the way through. I suppose what some people question on that is, are we really meant to take this as an actual week in the same way as we understand a week? Or are we just got a sequence of days here and we're not meant to take them as though they were the same chronological sort of phenomenon? There was a day 1, there was a period of time, a day 1, and so on. If you look at the word day as well, the first mention of the word day is in verse 5. And the second use of the word day is also in verse 5. It's the same Hebrew word yom, but there's two different meanings attached to it. So the first meaning of the word day in verse 5, what does it actually refer to, do you think?
When it's light.
Yeah, in other words, daytime. Mm. Certainly not a full day, as we understand it. Okay, you call the light day, as in daytime, daylight, and so on. And then when you come to the end of it, there was evening and morning, one day, day 1, whatever. That word day is being used in a different way from the first use of the word day. So already you've got two meanings of the same word, where one day is certainly bigger than the other one, because one is only daylight, one contains that, but also the period of darkness as well. And of course, day 7 is particularly unusual because it doesn't have a morning and an evening. It doesn't seem to stop in the same way. So even if these 7 days do form 1 week, there's no second week to follow it. and so on. In fact, the next mention of day is to do with the Sabbath, the seventh day. That's in chapter 2. In chapter 2 and verse 4, now I wonder again what your translation has for Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, which it has a sort of quite a long sort of thing. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created, when the Lord God made the earth and the heavens and so on. Actually, it won't come across in your translation, I don't imagine. But in chapter 2 and verse 4, the word day does actually occur in the original text. Does anyone have a translation of Genesis 2, 4 with the word day in it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. What do you got? Christine first.
In the day that the Lord God made the heaven, earth right. and heavens.
Okay, thank you. I'll come back to that. John, are you going to say the same thing?
It says the day that the Lord God made earth and heaven.
Yeah. Now, in my translation, I've got when. Just got the word when. Okay. So it starts off the same. This is the account, literally the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. And then my version goes on when the Lord God. But it runs through and actually says about the heavens and the earth when God created them in the day. Not the days, but the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. It literally is beyond in the day. So it's now been described as almost like one day. It's another use of the word day. We've had four uses now, back to 1:5, daylight, day one, Sabbath day, which is clearly a different kind of day. And now we've got a different use of the word, which is not always translated, but in the day when he did it, as though it all happened within, well, now one day, whatever these days actually mean. Malcolm?
The CJB verse 4 says, here is the history of the heavens and the earth when they were created. On the day when Adonai, God, made earth and heaven.
Yeah, on the day.
Yeah.
Back now to one day. So in other words, if you're really insisting upon six sort of literal days, which if you want to, that's fine by me, you've now got to work out what happens on that one day when it seems to sum up everything that he did as a single day's work, as opposed to 6 days or six periods of time. Okay. The real question is, I don't think when you look at a text like this, it's up to us to tell God how long he took. I don't think it's up to us to try and put our time perceptions, which, as we said, are not universal anyway. They are very much specific to us and our level of existence on earth. It's not up to us to try and interpret these when it's purely in terms of what God is doing, when he's doing things before the whole of creation is put into space and into place, rather, to tell him exactly what that would have been like if we had been sitting on earth with the time clock going on. But that's another point for me. John?
Just thinking sometimes we use in that day that such and such happened,
yeah,
meaning a period of time.
Yeah.
Or a cultural aspect of something or other.
Yeah.
Or you know,
yeah,
in that day, they, I don't know, couldn't fly, meaning
yeah,
for year, hundreds yeah, and hundreds yeah, and hundreds of years they couldn't fly, you know, couldn't
fly. And there's this strange phrase that people use, back in the day, when, you know, being very indeterminate, okay, when was that then? Or just, you know, he had his day. You know, like a prime minister had his day, but he was in power for several years and so on. So we use the word very flexibly as well and so on.
Yeah.
Jeremy?
Sorry.
People often refer also to the Ten Commandments, don't they? And they're talking about taking yeah, a Sabbath day, linking it particularly to the 6 or 7 days. So if it's not 7 days, why do they do that?
Okay, so I've slightly lost the question. That's my fault because I distracted myself. Can you just start the question again?
It's all right. I've just found the right glasses for looking at the right interlinear, and I've only just caught you up. But in terms of the argument about, well, the idea of 7 days,
yeah,
people often put forward that the Ten Commandments ask us to rest on the Sabbath as the seventh day.
Oh, right, okay.
7 days. So yeah, if it's not 7 days in the beginning, what is it?
Well, it's Exactly. But the point is, if you read it in Exodus 20, where it relates the week that the Israelites are going to experience and how they are to use that, that does not demand that you impose back onto Genesis 1 exactly the same kind of time structure. Okay, because our week doesn't have to be the same as God's week.
So what is it saying then in Genesis 1 and 2?
Well, it still leaves open several different ways of looking at it, which I think is the clever way of the whole narrative. So you can still look at it as being chronological in some way, or you can see it as just having a sort of framework. You don't have to think of it as a craftsman going about his work with evenings off, you know, going to sleep for the time because he's tired, getting up the next day, doing the next bit and the next bit, and the end of 6 days saying, that's it, I've finished, so I'm going to have a day off. In other words, the structure of the narrative, of the story of it, fits in with something that we already experience in a different way. But like all these things, like we were saying earlier, our experience of things should not be imposed back into the larger reality of things. So, for instance, if you go back to the idea of sight, we see things, but we only see certain things. God sees a lot more. His sight is much bigger than ours, and so on. So there's no reason why God had to work at all in any kind of time understanding that we currently have, because he was busy making it all at the same time, if you like. But then it's written up in such a way as we sort of understand it, but we're not meant to, just like we say when God sees things, we don't have to say, well, how many eyes has he got then? You know, has he got eyes in the back of his head if he sees more than I do? You know, it doesn't work backwards in that sort of way. You don't have to view the whole story as being some kind of chronological thing. In fact, people point out the problem, don't they, with the fourth day, where suddenly we seem to have got the means of light when we've already had light appear. So how do you get pre-solar light and so on? If this is purely an earth-based description, then how do you get the earlier bits happening before you've got the sun and moon in place and so on? Well, fine, that's because you don't have to actually look at it that way. But it's interesting that in verse 16, it doesn't say God created two great lights. Verse 16, have a look and see what it says in yours. Does it say created?
Made two great lights.
Made, okay. Anyone got a different word from made? Because it's not the same word as in the beginning God created, okay? And we know that the word for create actually means to make from nothing, to really, you know, start the whole thing off. But when you make something, as in verse 16, you can make it from something that already exists, the sort of existing material and so on. You can put something into place on the basis of stuff that you've already got, just like we make things. So the fact that it's a different verb there might add to a different way of understanding things. Maureen, oh, gone. Maureen had a hand up. Yeah, you're still getting up. Hello, can you unmute?
Thank you. I'm listening and taking this all in. And I looked at verse 4, and my Bible is the, excuse me, the King James Version. And it says, after it says about the seventh day, it says, these are the generations of the heavens and of the earth when they were created. The word generation springs to mind.
Yeah. Okay, that's chapter 2, verse 4, for those who, like me, were wondering. Well, it's chapter 2, verse 4. You're going back to that.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes, that's chapter fine. 2, verse 4.
Yeah.
It says, these are the generations of the heavens.
Exactly. Which is interesting, because if you look at, say, chapter 5 and verse 1 and many other places in Genesis, it always starts off, this is the account of, which is another way of saying these are the generations of. So it's treating the creation of the heavens and the earth in the same way then as the generations of Adam and of Noah and eventually Abraham and so on. The whole book of Genesis is split up into 10 accounts of the generations of, and it's as though before we get to any people type generations, this is a description of the generations, the generating of the heaven and the earth. That's the whole idea of Genesis, isn't it? The generations of those who have been made by other people, you know, the descendants of. So it's just a similar way of tying this particular narrative of the very beginning and so on with the other narratives to follow, which is of people and families. Does that help with that verse and why the word generations is there? Because actually, I think that's the right word to use. But our translators tend to use the word account or story of or something. Oh, Nigel, hello. You have to unmute, of course.
Hello. Sorry to arrive rather late. But I was just looking at this word make, and the primary translation does seem to be make, but the second one is really interesting. I've gone and closed my Bible app. That wasn't very clever.
You mean the second meaning of that same word?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is to, my Bible app has crashed, so I'll just try and remember it. It means to press or to squeeze the lights together.
Ah, okay. It certainly isn't the word bara, which is in the beginning, God created bara. Yeah. So it's almost like when you get to day four, if you like, God is still creating, but he's doing it slightly differently from in the other days. So, yeah. Press, as in what, like sort of compress, to sort of take something and... which probably fits in with how we think of the gaseous elements swirling around and then under gravity forming these huge stars. That's God still making something, yeah? Still the handiwork of him, the work of his hands doing all that. But he'd already created, as in the beginning created, all the necessary stuff to make things from it later. Okay.
I was also wondering whether, without thinking of it from a scientific point of view, we were talking about light already existing before the sun and the moon were made.
Yeah.
Maybe there was light that was generally around, and he compressed it into one source instead of being generally around.
That's a good point. Yeah, like at the moment, I've got a bulb up there, but basically I see the light all around the room, but it's coming from one vent from one source, but it's not quite the same, but I get the idea. Okay. I mean,
God is light, so there would have been light. Yeah,
if you like, but except he does create it. He does create something as well. So
in Revelation, it says that Jesus himself will be the light of the city. So,
yes.
I've always interpreted that as being what the light is in Genesis before the creation of this.
Well, coming back to what I said before you joined us about how we only experience things within certain frequencies, for us, light has to be something that enables us to see. But there is light outside of those ranges. We don't think of it as light because we don't see things that are outside of red and violet, but it's still light in the electromagnetic sense. It is still scientific physical light in some way, just it's not our source of light. And it's as though God took all the different wavelengths, frequencies or whatever, and suddenly created something within that particular range of it, which fitted in what he was going to do by making us. You know what I mean? It's all about God creating a lot of the universe, or this bit of the universe, specifically for the people he was going to put in it, us. That's what's wonderful. And it's the same with time. Sorry, we got, I don't know who was first, but...
Jeremy.
Okay.
Yes, there seems to be, you know, that making of difference, doesn't there, that God does and that we're supposed to maintain, I think. But I was just thinking about the way in which the sun and the moon and the stars are compressed or in whatever manner. That does affect time, doesn't it, going back to our
situation,
because gravity and time are together, aren't they?
Yes, and before God made all these things, time was existing, but it would have been flowing at lots of different rates because it's affected by mass and by speed. And it's outside of our range of experience and understanding. So when we try and say, oh, it took so many billion years for this to happen and so on, that's assuming we're standing here on Earth and able to observe backwards in time that was flowing in the same way, but it wasn't. It's only an appearance of time from our understanding of it. Who knows exactly how much time was actually passing when all these things were going on. We just can't know. Malcolm.
So back to Genesis 1 verse 3, I'd always understood that the illumination before God created light was the Shekinah of God.
Yeah, but then he isn't, I'm going to put this, he then created, I mean, there was always that there, but because he exists beforehand. But when he starts to make the heavens and the earth, then there's a new kind of light comes into being. But he's doing something that relates to what he is like, certainly. Yeah. And it's still very sort of mysterious and all that.
Yeah, Paul, don't we have to be a bit careful that we're not trying to put God into what our imaginations can deal with?
Yes, and that really is the point of everything almost I've been saying. Be very careful of anybody, whether it's a scientist, a theologian, or just a man in the street, who tries to talk of these things as though God had to do things in the way that we do them, or the only way that we understand them, because things are different. And time is the one thing, because we used to think that time was just like a big universal clock going tick-tock all the way through. Everything was past, present, or future, and so on. Now we know it's a whole different set of reality. It's even worse when we try and make God fit our time scales of things, when he operates not only sort of outside of time, but he operates even within creation in different time ways than we normally do. We are very limited again in how we understand anything that he has made. Because we adapt everything to our short range sort of experiences, and our short range experiences go from basically a second up to maybe 100 years or more, but anything big or smaller, it gets almost unfathomable to us. We've got a hand, Mike.
I was just looking at the in verse 16, I was looking at the interlinear. When it says God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. And in the Hebrew, it goes just the stars also.
Yeah.
So he made actually isn't in the text.
Okay. It was the English has added it in just to make it a bit more user-friendly as a sentence, I guess. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, he made this, and also that. We put a full stop, we punctuated it, and therefore added the verb back in again. Yeah. Okay. As I said, I read this fascinating little book, which set me thinking in all sorts of different ways, which I think is always a good thing about a book. Drives me back to the Bible to check one or two things out. It makes me think about it in a slightly different way. I always used to say Genesis chapter 1 is poetry, because there's so much in verse 3 onwards which is poetry, reads like poetry to some extent, but actually it isn't quite the same as Hebrew poetry. Apparently it's best to see it as a prose narrative with semi-poetical elements. Okay, I'll get my head around that eventually, I suppose. But it's about making it memorable. It's about giving an ordered narrative in order to help us grasp something, rather than even say that that's exactly step by step how it happened in time, whatever time was like then. It's a little bit like if you want to know how a building was put together, you might be able to see the blueprint, you might be able to go through the sort of path analysis that the builders have to do in order to put this in place and that in place and that in place and so on. But once it's built and you look back at it, you probably have a different appreciation of how it was put together than the actual work that the builder did, which you never really were, you know, privy to. You're trying to work it out from the end product. So perhaps we're trying to do something similar. And I love the way science discovers things, and I love all these programs that take me into the mysteries of all this and all that, because if you've got an understanding of God and faith in him and hold on to the very important fact of him being the creator, then it's a wonderful thing, which is meant to increase your worship and your sense of wonder and mystery at who he is. But even the fact that God said something, did he really speak? What kind Why of words not? Did he really say again?
Why not?
Well, yeah, exactly. But in what way was that speech? Was it like our speech? Do we assume that he used words in the same way that we did? Does he have a voice as such? No, but somehow he verbalized his thinking, his will, and so on. He expressed it in a certain way. And one way in which people look at this is to say that on six separate days, whatever they were, God issued a command each time, and then it took however long it took for that command to be affected, to be sort of worked out, as though God speaks quickly but works slowly. So you've almost got two time spans going on here, the time span of God saying this, saying that, but then there's another time span going on in which the actual work happens, shall we say, comes to pass. Before he actually sees it and says, oh, that's good. Now move on to step two, if you like, and so on. So it leaves us to, I think, read the text in all sorts of interesting ways, different ways. It doesn't destroy the main purpose and meaning of it. And it's just packed full of different ways of digging into what the text actually says. Right, well, we've had our time, and I've certainly said enough, and I hope there wasn't too much bamboozling physical sort of stuff there, but as a sort of mathematician, well, as a mathematician, but not a high-powered one, I do find it interesting when people who study this sort of thing in more details say that this is what we have discovered in recent years, increasingly, and it's just like it opens everything up in a new way, which is, I think, fascinating. Next time, we are going to start looking at a particular biblical book, but again, sorry, I'm going to hold that under my hat for a while. Come back next week to find out which book it is. Not going to say anything about it, but I'll give you some introduction to it. We'll then read some of it, discuss it, and then that will go on for the next week and the next week and maybe another week. So it's going to be long enough to keep us going for a month. And we'll do one or two little odd items around that as well. So come back next time for a biblical book.
Thank you.
Can we switch off the recording now then? I think
just we've, do it. Yeah.